Welcome to Intelligent Medicine, America's foremost program on health, medicine, and nutrition, featuring the latest on both conventional and alternative therapies. Now, here's Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and welcome to all our affiliates across the country as we rejoin you. And this is Labor Day, so a happy Labor Day to all of you. And a reminder, this program is live on a weekend when a lot of shows are canned or pre-recorded. We're here for you, and we're here to answer your questions. 888-302-3684. You can start dialing. And among the stories we're going to talk about this weekend, a highly charged issue of vaccine safety. There's a new whistleblower who has appeared on the subject of the vaccine autism link, and it's creating a firestorm of controversy. We'll talk about that in just a few moments. Also, does meat kill you? Literally, some people claim that meat consumption shortens your life, and we'll examine that contention on the basis of a brand new study that evaluates precisely that issue. 888-302-3684. But of course, the big issue this weekend, something that we must touch upon, is the tragic circumstances of Joan Rivers, who is at this very moment in a New York City hospital in a medically induced coma after undergoing what seemed like a routine minor medical procedure. She had a cardiac arrest and then was 911 to Mount Sinai Hospital. So what the heck is going on with that? How did that happen? And what's the story? You know, I know Joan. I worked with her when she broadcast from our flagship radio station in New York City, WOR. She was a host in WOR, and I was on right after her. So we literally saw each other virtually every night because she was in the studio, and then she would leave the studio and I would say hi. And I got to say, she is the night. She's, you know, she may be acerbic in her act, but in person, she's just a lovely, gracious, kind-hearted person. Very, very low key and polite, and just a wonderfully vibrant individual. And, you know, we hope that she does well and that she recovers from this terrible setback. But, you know, Joan clearly is not a stranger to cosmetic procedures. In fact, one of her memorable quotes is, "I've had so much plastic surgery. When I die, they will donate my body to Tupperware." So she's gone under the knife so many times, and this time it didn't work out well. She apparently was having some kind of procedure on her vocal cords. It's not clear what. There are a variety of things that can afflict performers that can impair their performance. Just vocal overuse can damage your vocal cords. This is a really common problem among singers. For example, rock singer John Mayer had vocal polyp surgery. Polyps are like little, almost like little calluses that develop on your vocal cords. And they can be sliced away with scalpel surgery, or these days what they use is they often use laser surgery to deal with these. Also, the singer Adele, famously a couple years ago, 2012, after her hit songs, her voice gave out. She had to undergo vocal cord surgery. Keith Urban, country and western singer. And Julie Andrews memorably had a bad outcome with vocal cord surgery in 1997. It was literally a career ending for her in terms of her singing career, because it was a rare instance where the surgery backfired and damaged her vocal cords. But there's one other aspect to this. Not a lot of people have talked about this, is there is a procedure called a voice lift. What in the heck is a voice lift? Well, voice lift is, you know, many people as they age, I mean, you can usually tell a person who is older by their voice. you know, perhaps when I'm doing intelligent medicine, when I'm aged 81 like Joan, I might have a scratchy, you know, elderly sounding voice because the vocal cords age and they get damaged with overuse. But just like other body parts, they age and wear out. And there is a procedure called a voice lift in which fat is introduced into the vocal cords to plump them up, or other materials that sometimes are used in cosmetic plastic surgery to change the contour and shape of the vocal cords to improve the voice. And one wonders, you know, was that possibly the surgery that she underwent? And it seems like a cautionary tale, because here was something that was non-emergency. It wasn't like she had, we don't know, but it's unlikely that she had cancer of the vocal cords that would absolutely necessitate surgery. This may have been just a way to refresh her voice, because she is constantly performing on a very rigorous schedule. So the surgery that she undertook was outpatient surgery. Outpatient surgery is in vogue because it, you know, hospitals have crowded surgical schedules. It's cheaper to do it out of the hospital. It's also more profitable, frankly, for doctors, because doctors own surgical suites outside of hospitals. And so they can make the money that ordinarily the hospital would charge for performing the surgery. As of 2006, 35 million outpatient procedures were performed in the United States, and very rarely do they result in complications. 1 in 200 is the complication rate, but usually for something like bleeding that's poorly controlled, anesthesia reactions that are minor, but certainly not cardiac arrest. That's literally like, you know, 1 in a million kind of situation. But when a patient is older, the risks increase. And Joan ostensibly was a healthy 81-year-old, but nonetheless, she suffered some sort of incident while undergoing surgery. And so the question I have, I don't really know, was the surgery done under general anesthesia? General anesthesia sometimes involves putting a tube down your throat to breathe for you. Although she may have just been under sedating anesthesia where she was breathing on her own, and she might have received an anesthetic like propofol, like the stuff that Michael Jackson succumbed to. Now, it's used a lot in surgery. I'm not saying it's deadly. When misused, like in Michael Jackson's case, or abused, it can be deadly. But it is highly sedating. And sometimes things go wrong. It's a little too much is used, or the patient is very sensitive, or perhaps due to the instrumentation down there, there's a spasm of the larynx and the airway closes. People stop breathing. The other question that I have is, you know, if it was done off-premises from a hospital, was it a medical doctor administering the anesthesia, or was it a nurse anesthetist, perhaps a less experienced individual? All this will be, I'm sure, carefully evaluated and maybe ultimately litigated, because, you know, whenever you see stuff go awry, always there's the specter of malpractice. Did they do something wrong? All these outpatient surgical facilities are equipped for emergencies. They have complete crash carts, defibrillators, oxygen, etc., medications, because it's critical to, you know, if a patient has a cardiac arrest, to resuscitate them quickly, because with every second that your heart's not beating, that your brain becomes oxygen deprived. And they say in the accounts of this episode, they 911 heard an ambulance from the surgical facility to a nearby hospital, but how long her heart had stopped before she was resuscitated is unclear, and that determines survival. Survival for out-of-hospital cardiac arrests is pretty dismal. You know, you see often, you know, on the TV shows, you know, they do a code blue and they resuscitate the patient. The patient survives. You know, most of the time, while there is a chance of survival, maybe 10-20% out of hospital, people don't do well. They don't survive. This is sort of an intermediate situation because it happened outside the hospital, but didn't happen on the sidewalk. It happened in a medical facility where emergency measures were undertaken to resuscitate Joan Rivers. And so they say now she's resting comfortably in hospital. Well, that's sort of a euphemism, because she's actually in a medically induced coma. Resting comfortably. But yeah, I mean, when you're getting very, very sedating medication and getting drugs that paralyze your limbs, you're going to rest comfortably. What's the purpose of a medically induced coma? Well, usually they do these things after a cardiac arrest to slow the body down, slow the brain down. It actually is part and parcel of a treatment called hypothermia, where they cool the body, which actually reduces the demands on the brain. And the way they discovered the benefits of hypothermia, it was discovered after people survived immersion in frozen lakes. People would fall through holes in, you know, the ice. The ice would crack and they'd get immersed under in frozen water, and they would be immersed for many minutes at a time and then survive. And they discovered, oh, if you keep the body cool, you can survive prolonged periods of oxygen deprivation of the brain. So they're intentionally depriving your brain of oxygen, but they usually don't do that for very long. By the way, the medically induced coma is designed to control shivering, which uses up energy and can deplete the body when you're getting hypothermia. So they go hand in hand, hypothermia and medically induced coma. They're going to do this, they say, for 24 to 48 hours. And at some time this weekend, probably, she's scheduled to be taken out of a medically induced coma so that a proper neurological exam can be performed. That means they're going to see, you know, how's she doing? Because if you're in a medically induced coma, they can't ask her questions or do tests, look in the pupils of her eyes, do brainwave tests to see what brain activity is there. And we hope that after this ordeal that she will return Lazarus-like out of a deep freeze and be fully intact. Our prayers are with her and with her family, who are conducting a vigil by her bedside. She's a great lady, and we hope that she does well. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.
Wellness is just a click away. Go to drhoffman.com.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. 888-302-3684 is our number. And just a postscript to the discussion of vocal problems apropos Joan Rivers' surgery. Many vocal problems can be handled with just simple conservative measures. I'm not saying that Jones could have, but there's a whole branch of physical therapy called vocal rehab, where singers and performers and announcers like myself learn how to talk better or sing better or not damage their vocal cords. I guess you couldn't have done that with, some of the screechy rock singers of legends of the past, like Janis Joplin or Jim Morrison. But there are better ways to use your vocal cords that can preserve them. Also, many patients with vocal problems have GERD or reflux, and that can be treated with medication or, better yet, with diet modification. We can use, if you have polyps on your vocal cords, one of the natural therapies that I find helpful is DIM, which is a cabbage family vegetable, helpful for papillomas, polyps that can form on the vocal cords. The use of oral iodine can be helpful for some of these problems. And one of the most interesting therapies really works. I've seen it work on many of my patients. Intravenous glutathione, actually a therapy pioneered by Dr. Ben Asher, who's been a guest on Intelligent Medicine in the past. You've done some podcasts with him. He has a big practice consisting of opera singers and performers, and many of them have come to him for vocal problems because he's an ear, nose, and throat specialist with an integrative perspective. And he has written articles on intravenous glutathione, which can be helpful for clearing up vocal problems. All right, let's talk to Sal. Welcome.
I've seen advertisements for a stem cell center. They use your own stem cells to treat you.
To treat you for what kind of conditions?
Almost everything.
Almost everything. Okay, so let me tell you the deal with stem cells. You know, stem cells have, I think, great potential, and a lot of research is underway on stem cells to treat very serious and profound degenerative conditions like Parkinson's disease and ALS and spinal cord injury. But stem cells are not yet ready for prime time, in my opinion, for those conditions. They're working on it, but they haven't quite nailed it down. So people who claim that stem cells either here or overseas You know, sometimes you go to a country where there's less stringent regulations, where they allow this, China or Costa Rica or places like that. There are sort of international free fire zones for medical therapies that are maybe not quite ready for prime time. They administer these therapies, sometimes at great cost, and I don't think with a lot of proof of efficacy. However, I think stem cells have great potential at the present time for treatment of, say, joint problems. They're already being used for knees, for hips, for regenerating cartilage. And from what I understand, you know, they sometimes take the stem cells from your abdominal fat. That's easy because, you know, you can virtually everyone can pinch an inch and they can stick a needle in there. You can pull out some fat cells and then process them in some way that they can then reintroduce them into your body. And this also eliminates the problem of you being allergic or, you know, having an immunological reaction to foreign material because it's your own material. So it's autologous. It's from you. But the better technique that I hear now is being used is they have to go into your bone marrow. They suck it out. They, you know, either go into your breastbone or preferably into your hip bone. They pull out some bone marrow. And that those stem cells, I've now heard, are more efficacious for dealing with joint problems. And eventually we may be able to tweak these cells into cells that can regenerate hearts after, you know, damaging heart attacks, make people walk again after their spinal cords have been severed. They're on track with that. But, you know, I sometimes think the claims are a little exaggerated, and we're not quite ready for prime time with stem cell therapy.
Doc, I've seen a company that says that they could mail you a supplement that will release your own stem cells.
That's ridiculous. I mean, that whole notion, I mean, that's really fraud. Because, you know, they take things like growth hormone, which has some scientific basis, and then they say, well, take this oral growth hormone releaser. Same thing with testosterone. They say, well, testosterone does this and this, but you could just buy this, you know, get it, buy it online. Take, you know, for $39.95, you can take these pills. They release testosterone. That doesn't work. Same thing with stem cells. That's a hype. I mean, people are drafting on the popularity of the term stem cells. Same thing with oral chelation. Doesn't work. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, 888-302-684. And when we return, we're going to investigate a highly charged issue, the issue of vaccine injury.
We all know that humans need probiotics, but your dog needs probiotics too. Some dogs have chronic digestive issues just like humans. Probiotics will aid digestion and help improve overall immune health. Hi, I'm Gail Pruitt, certified nutritionist and author of the Doggone Good Cookbook. I do nutritional research for both humans and canines, focusing primarily on digestive issues. So whether your dog has chronic digestive issues or just the occasional upset, I recommend that you give your dog a daily probiotic to balance your dog's gut flora. You know, eating right and taking the right supplements are so important for your good health and for your best friends. And the best probiotics I've found is Dr. O'Hara's probiotics. So make sure the nutrients you and your dog eat are providing the maximum benefits. And always share your Dr. O'Hara's probiotics. Your dog will love you for it.
Discover the Dr. O'Hara difference. Dr. O'Hara's probiotics are available at Vitamin Shop, Whole Foods, Sprouts, and other fine health food stores nationwide.
DrHoffman.com, your portal for cutting-edge information on health and nutrition.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. If you want to find out the latest about the alternative cancer scene, I did a great podcast this week with Ralph Moss, who is an intrepid investigative journalist, and we really blow the lid off the cancer establishment on one of my podcasts that you can find at drhoffman.com. So check it out. He's got a new movie entitled Second Opinion. We talk about Second Opinion on our podcast with Ralph Moss this week, available at drhoffman.com. Please listen. All right, speaking of investigative journalists, Cheryl Atkinson, it's not Atkinson, it's Atkinson, is a former CBS reporter. They didn't like her over there because she was kind of a loose cannon. She was aggressively investigating the vaccination autism link and actually gave it some credence in her reporting, which was objective and not sensationalistic. She also had some pretty unkind things to say about the current administration and their climate of secrecy. So she left CBS and now has her own independent website. Check it out, Cheryl Atkinson. And she reports this week on a huge firestorm that is happening in the vaccine world about a potential connection between vaccination and autism. And this is important because we really need to keep the debate open on not just should you get a vaccine or shouldn't get a vaccine, but should we be selective about vaccinating certain kids? Is it proper to give them all the vaccines at once? Is it best to withhold some vaccines from some kids for some period of time? Is there a way of testing kids to see if they're going to have vaccine reactions? Now, clearly, and Cheryl Atkinson and other responsible critics of vaccination will admit that the vast majority of kids don't have vaccine reactions, but a small minority may. And this controversy goes to the heart of that. So let me tell you what's happening. There's a whistleblower who's emerged. He is a very prominent Centers for Disease Control and Prevention researcher. He's an epidemiologist named William Thompson. He's a PhD. And he issued a statement this week that's a very peculiar, unusual, if not unprecedented statement for a sitting CDC senior scientist to make. He says, quote, "I regret that my co-authors and I omitted statistically significant information in our 2004 article published in the journal Pediatrics. The omitted data suggested that African-American males who received the MMR vaccine before age 36 months were at increased risk for autism." Wow. By the way, he's got a lawyer now. His statement was issued through his attorney because this is a big deal. This goes to, you know, scientific integrity, and he is going to be the target of enormous pressure from the Centers for Disease Control, his previous employers, because they do not want to instill any loss of confidence in the populace about vaccines. There's enough what they call vaccine denialism already. They claim that, like global warming or climate change, it's settled science. And they don't want people to become refuseniks and not have their kids vaccinated, because we're actually seeing a resurgence of certain infectious diseases. Measles and whooping cough are coming back because some parents are saying, no, I don't want to vaccinate my kid. My kid's going to get autism. Well, I get their perspective, but when questions arise, we can't cover them up. And the CDC immediately replied that the publication Pediatrics stands by the study despite the news, and they say that the research was correct. It all started, interestingly, when Thompson, he's the whistleblower, Dr. Thompson had some off-the-record, he thought, phone conversations with Dr. Brian Hook. And Dr. Hooker is a critic of vaccines. So they had some informal conversations on the phone. Unbeknownst to Dr. Thompson, Dr. Hooker recorded these conversations. And he said some things that were potentially embarrassing in his frank conversations with Dr. Hooker. He said, "This is the lowest point in my career that I went along with that paper. I went along with this. We didn't report significant findings." So perhaps threatened with being outed by Dr. Hooker in his informal, frank conversation about the study, he got out ahead of it and said, "Look, I have some concerns about the way they manipulated data in the study done in the medical journal Pediatrics." Now, the Centers for Disease Control say, "Look, it's impossible. It can't be. There's just no way there's a vaccine autism link." Their claim is, quote, "Vaccine exposure around 3 years of age is just not biologically plausible to have a causal association with autism. It would mean that autism would have already started by then. It probably starts in the womb. So I think from a biological argument, it's implausible this was a causal association." I personally think that that's a shaky assumption. And many parents of autistic children will tell you that it seems their kids develop normally. They got a whole round of vaccines, and then around the age of 2 or 3, they seem to regress. That's what they say. It's a controversial assertion. But what Cheryl Atkinson is saying is, look, overall, vaccines are probably safe if you look at the aggregate. But in certain subgroups, perhaps certain races, certain types of kids with genetic predispositions, there may be a higher risk of some sort of immunological reaction when they get multiple vaccines. And we need to keep an open mind, and we need to shine the light of scientific inquiry on this and not get caught up in emotional arguments. Vaccines are perfectly fine. No way vaccines are all harmful. The truth lies somewhere in between, as it does in so many scientific debates. But this is a big controversy that's really reactivating concerns about our current schedule of vaccinations for kids. We'll be talking about this issue throughout the year, and we'll do some special investigative reports via our podcast on Intelligent Medicine in 2014 and 2015. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.
This traffic report from the bloodstream brought to you by Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract. Well, that inbound blood flow is really slowing down now due to plaque from cholesterol, but help's on the way from Kyolic. More than 750 peer-reviewed research studies indicate that Kyolic not only keeps circulation moving smoothly, it also helps improve a number of cardiovascular risk factors. Kyolic provides powerful antioxidants that help keep your arteries healthy. It reduces homocysteine, a risk factor for heart disease. Unlike other garlic products, Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract is made from 100% organically grown garlic, is completely odorless, and won't upset your stomach. With all of these heart-healthy benefits, it's no surprise that Kyolic is the best-selling garlic supplement in the world. Look for Kyolic at Vitamin Shop, Whole Foods, Sprouts, GNC, and fine health food stores everywhere. Help keep your system stay humming along with Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract today.
Why do I use Clear Sinus Care? Because I like to breathe.
Because I hate having a dry nose.
There are a lot of reasons to use Clear Sinus Care, the nasal rinse and sinus spray with xylitol. But the best reason is because it works.
I use Clear because my doctor told me to.
Because it's all natural.
Clear, spelled X-L-E-A-R, moisturizes and soothes those dry and irritated sinuses. Clear Sinus Care not only helps with dry air problems, it also helps wash away pollens, pollutants, and other airborne contaminants, making your sinus passageways all clear.
Because my snoring was keeping my wife awake.
Because now I'm not all stuffed up.
And because it's all natural, Clear is 100% safe for children. The perfect way to keep your whole family healthy and breathing right. Prevent the misery and stop the suffering with Clear. That's X-L-E-A-R at clear.com and fine retailers.
Available at Whole Foods, Vitamin Shoppe, and other fine natural products retailers.
A regular dose of Intelligent Medicine injected directly into your inbox. Subscribe to Dr. Hoffman's free newsletter. Just go to drhoffman.com.
Back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you on this beautiful Labor Day weekend. And Justin from Montreal, Canada. Welcome.
Dr. Hoffman, how are you doing?
Good, thanks.
I have a question for you today about a condition that I'm working with on my tongue.
Okay.
So this is something that I did have a biopsy on in January of 2010, and it did come back CIS, carcinoma in situ.
Okay, so that would be like a pre-cancer, like a something that might eventually lead, sort of like an abnormal pap smear in a woman's cervix or Barrett's esophagus in the esophagus. Actually, I did a podcast on that subject that you may want to check out at drhoffman.com, because some of the same things that apply to cervical tissue and esophageal tissue may apply to tongue tissue in terms of preventing progression towards cancer. But go ahead.
Very interesting. Thank you. I did 3 years of, holistic treatments, detoxification, amalgam removal, and many other things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was all clear and fine and beautiful. The lesion went away until April of this year, where it's not that the lesion has come back. It's that there is now a marked thickening in the tongue.
Hmm. But non-cancerous, right?
I have not had another biopsy. I did not enjoy my last biopsy.
Yeah, they're very painful in the mouth. Well, you know, I'm going to urge you to have a follow-up. By the way, for you, fairly easy to get medical care up there in Canada under the system?
Fairly easy, yeah.
Good. Okay, so you had no long delays. They didn't put you on a back burner or anything.
There's long delays, sir.
Oh, okay. So for our U.S. listeners, listen up, because it's not quite the same there. All right, so here's the deal. You need a holistic program is important. And among the things that I think would be most helpful, high-dose mixed carotenoids, and you can get them from vegetable juicing and from fresh fruit, all the natural compounds you find in green, yellow, red, and purple fruits and vegetables. Can make a difference here. I've actually regressed precancerous lesions in the mouth in the past with beta carotene, but these days we prefer mixed carotenoids, high dose beta carotene, like 100,000 international units. You could also take higher doses of vitamin A, because vitamin A may help these types of lesions regress, perhaps 25 or 50,000 international units. But you have to be careful. There's toxicity with vitamin A, not with beta carotene or mixed carotenoids. Then the things that could be helpful. Okay, well, green tea, EGCG at high doses. DIM, which is from cabbage family. That is available over the counter. I don't know if it's available in Canada, but it's certainly available here. Sulforaphane glucosinolator, SGS, which is an extract of broccoli sprouts, has profound anti-cancer effects on surfaces of the body. This could be important in the mouth. You may also consider higher doses of omega-3 fatty acids and vitamin D, because they have anti-cancer effects. Also, in pre-cancer, folate, which is available in plants. That's why foliage yields folate, the natural form that folic acid is actually a synthetic form of. But the product that's available in the United States, methylfolate, helps with precancer. I don't advocate lots of folic acid if you already have a cancer. So precancer, you can sort of slow the progression towards cancer with a methylated folate. It's called methylfolate or 5-methylfolate. So these are some of the things. Pomegranate may have anti-cancer effects. That's a pretty important thing to consider. Curcumin has anti-cancer effects. These are some things you may want to pickle your body with, literally take large amounts, because eventually that's going to circulate to the tissue in your tongue and will be bioavailable for the cells that may be moving towards cancer there. Those are some of the things that I would try. But the thickening throws me. I mean, maybe it's your body's reaction to chronic inflammation. And it's a good thing that the thickening is occurring, because it's non-cancerous cells. But any change in the consistency of your tongue, I think you need to get it investigated, get it checked out, get someone to examine it and do a biopsy, perhaps. I know it's painful, but make sure that it's gone, because you want to check that early. Mouth cancer, if caught early, it's a cure. Like Michael Douglas, it's fine. But when it comes to mouth cancer that's spread or metastasized, that's another story. So, all right. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And this is Intelligent Medicine.
Wellness is just a click away. Go to drhoffman.com.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. And I promised to share this story with you. Does meat kill you? A lot of people allege that meat shortens your life, increases the risk of heart disease, cancer, and so on. And so a definitive study performed in Sweden. I'm going to cut to the chase here. It turns out that high total red meat consumption was associated with shorter survival. But check this out. They actually divided it between processed meat and non-processed meat. And what they found was, and this is, say, I've been telling you this for a long time, consumption of non-processed red meat alone was not associated with shorter survival. So there you have it. Large definitive study. Non-processed meat, not the culprit when it comes to shortening your lifespan. All right, let's talk to Lori in Brooklyn. Welcome.
Hello, Dr. Hoffman.
Yep.
Yes. Okay, I'm looking at the time, and I want to be as quick as I can.
Go ahead.
It's near the two. Okay, I have a lot of feverish sweats. They feel like menopausal flashes, but I'm over the menopause so for some time. So we.
Do you have is there an increased temperature on the thermometer?
Not really, no. I take the temperature and it times is 98.3 or 98.6.
Okay, so let me just say that you have some kind of dysregulation of your autonomic nervous system. You feel feverish, but it's like you're flushing and you're having blood rushing to the surface and there's a loss of control of that. Now, that could be related to hormones, although and it sometimes happens in women as a delay. You know, it may happen 10 or 15 years after menopause. That's not unheard of. It happens in perhaps 5% of women. The other possibility, and you really need to check this out, if you were a patient coming to see me at the Hoffman Center, one of the first tests I would perform is a glucose tolerance test, because the symptoms of hypoglycemia, low blood sugar, often mimic the symptoms of hot flashes. Men can break into a sweat, a cold sweat. They become flushed and then alternatively chilled and break into a sweat when their blood sugar plummets. And that is a very common problem, especially if people age. They have metabolic syndrome. They have excess insulin production. On a glucose tolerance test, we'd see their blood sugar soar and then alternatively plummet. And when the blood sugar plummets down to, you know, 60 or 50 or even 40, then surely you're going to experience symptoms that sound like what you're having. I mean, alternatively, you could have some kind of infection. We could check you for any number of things, Lyme disease, viruses. But before we do that, blood sugar is a likely culprit. All right. Thanks very much for joining us. Remember, Intelligent Medicine, this radio program, is but the tip of the iceberg of the Intelligent Medicine phenomenon, because we've got podcasts galore at drhoffman.com. We've got great articles. And you can sign up for our free newsletter. So make sure that you jump into fall armed with the best and the latest health information via Intelligent Medicine. Check it out at drhoffman.com. Have yourselves a great Labor Day. Enjoy. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman.